Challenger's dojo was on H deck, and was spacious and nicely appointed, with a real wood floor and paper panels concealing the metal bulkheads. The collected invitees, the duelists, the Challenger command staff, Krontep and Finney, and a couple of people from Enterprise, were ranked along one of the long walls, some almost quivering with excitement. At precisely 1500 hours, the doors at both ends of the room opened, and a person strode through each one. From one end came Griffin, his IPO uniform traded for a gi and hakama of white and deep blue, respectively. He had a daisho thrust through his obi, matched blades with wrappings of black cord over scarlet ray skin, and there was something in his bearing that many of those in the room had never seen before. He was moving with a purpose, a deadly seriousness at odds with his usual, somewhat leisurely bearing. Uchina, in line with the rest, recognized it instantly. It was what she liked to call his sensei mode. From the opposite door, Caitlin emerged. She wore black hakama and a black monske, quilted with orange thread, and had her slightly curly brown hair tied back in a loose ponytail with an orange ribbon. Tucked into the breast pocket of her monske was an orange rose. The duelist leader held her zatoichi in her left hand, and she was moving with that same purposeful grace, her brown eyes wearing the same intent expression behind her big round glasses. "Caitlin Yuriko Hutchins," said Griffin, his voice as forceful as his aspect. "Journeywoman of the Asagiri Katsujin Kenryu. You stand before your master and your peers today, having performed the final defensive technique, the Blade of the Inviolate Soul, in battle. Do you intend to claim the rank which is yours by right of that technique?" Caitlin elevated her chin a bit, locked eyes with her father across the room, and said clearly, "Sensei, I do." "Such a thing is not won easily," Griffin informed her. "You will face many challengers, challengers who will not be impressed by a sharp blade or a master's rank. You must demonstrate your willingness to face them, your determination to oppose them, and your power to survive them. Are you ready to meet those challengers?"
"Sensei, I am," Caitlin replied, firmly, unhesitatingly.
Griffin nodded. "So be it," he said. In one smooth stride, he glided without looking back to the wall, then sank into Seiza and rapped out a single word like the report of a gun. "Begin!"
As if activated by the sound, Utena Tenjo launched herself out of the line, her duelist's embellishments sizzling into being upon her Otori Academy uniform, the thorn of the rose flickering from its scabbard. Without showing the slightest surprise, Caitlin pivoted, took a half-step back, shucked her blade from its wooden scabbard, and met her roommate's charge. They clashed, clashed again, backed, ducked, ranged around the room in a breathtaking display of skill, drive, and athleticism. Utena knew her best friend would never forgive her if she gave this fight anything less than everything she had, and so she did, throwing herself into the battle as though the Rose Bride herself were at stake. Well, maybe not quite that hard. This was the second time they had met in open battle, dueling rather than sparring. And just like the last time, Caitlin edged her roommate narrowly, scattering her white rose upon the floor of the room.
"Next!" Caitlin barked as Utena, flushed and slightly winded, retired. Her own involvement in the trial over, Utena sat down in her place against the wall and watched with fascination as Miki Kaworu took his turn. One by one, the duelists faced the president of their society. One by one, they tested her. One by one, they fell, until the floor of the dojo was littered with rose petals of a dozen colors. Miki, Wakaba, Sayanji, Skaya, Amanda, with their blades and styles of all different types, all clashed with Caitlin and came away the loser. And through it all, Kate spoke only that single word, once, after each victory. Even Utena, who had seen Caitlin intent, was amazed at the brown-haired duelist's focus. It was as bright as a laser, as inevitable as a glacier. Mia Ausa and her Anlashok battlestaff provided the greatest contrast in weapon and style, and seemed to give Kate the most trouble of any of the duelists she'd faced to that time. Several times Mia tripped her up, sending her sprawling, but she always rolled to her feet, managing just barely to avoid the follow-up strike and launch a counterattack that sent the half-Minbari girl scrambling to consolidate her position. Eventually, it was one of these explosive counterstrikes that relieved Mia of her rose and brought into the game the last of the Institute duelists. Jury's turn, as Utrina knew it had to be, was spectacular. The red-headed fencer was the best of the Atori Academy transplants in technical ability, and today she fought with something that was normally missing from her approach to combat in Utrina's experience, inspiration. Remembering the difficulties of facing an uninspired jury, Utrina didn't envy her roommate this clash with a jury who had a fire burning inside her. If Jury was inspired, though, Caitlin was touched by something divine. Her color rising, her eyes flashing, she met everything the redhead threw at her and gave it back in turn. They fought from one end of the room to the other, once scattering the onlookers, once nearly treading on Griffin-sensei where he sat silent and immobile, watching everything, perhaps seeing more than was plainly visible. Slowly, as this epic struggle raged around him, slowly, Utrina saw a smile forming on the man's lips. Caitlin and Jury clashed, locked their blades, circled each other, then flung themselves apart, regrouped, and hurled themselves past each other. Caitlin's rose scattered. There was an audible sound of alarm and disappointment from the assembled. Even Jury looked crestfallen that she had won. She turned, her blade drooping, and said in a disconsolate tone, "Kate, I..." Caitlin turned, bowed to her, then reached out, took Jury's rose, and placed it in her own breast pocket. Jury blinked in surprise. The faintest smile cracked the serious mask of Kate's face for just an instant, and she flickered one eyelid in a very quick wink. Then she hardened once more, raised her sword, and barked, "Again!" Utrina was momentarily confused. Did that mean they were going to start over? Should she go back out? Nobody had told her about this part. She was just about to get up again when she noticed someone else rising instead, and her eyebrows went up. She had assumed that Corwin, in the black and silver of the Valkyrie dress uniform he'd worn to the spring formal, was just there as a spectator, but no. He was taking the floor. Unarmed? The black-haired young man squared himself opposite his sister and flung his silver-edged black cloak back over his shoulders. Then he held his hands up, spread apart, palms forward, and bellowed, "Come to my hand! Stick!" With a searing noise, a 6-foot splinter of light appeared in the air in front of him, within the span of his hands. As he closed his hands around that light, it seemed to crystallize, then shatter outward into a million tiny rays that scattered and were gone. Where it had been, he held a hexagonal staff of blonde wood, about the thickness of a flashlight, shod at each end with a gleaming cap of silvery metal. Black runes marched down the middle of the staff's outward face. Utrina knew them. The same runes, in red, gleamed on the blade of the Thorn of the Rose, a traditional slogan for a Valkyrie's weapon, Corwin had said. What ensued was, for Utrina, almost as eye-opening as Kate's clash with Jury. She had never seen Corwin fight before, hadn't really given much thought to the idea that he could. Oh, she knew he was a Valkyrie, the first male one in history, thanks to the fact that his mother was the goddess of the future, and the Valkyrier's leader, Skuld Ravenhair. She knew he'd been trained in the arts of war by his mother's troops, he'd told her. But somehow it had never really sunk in what that had to mean until this moment. He handled that length of wood, stick, apparently, like an artist, whipping it around his body and bringing it into and out of play with little flourishes that spoke of a trained, talented, and motivated combatant. Like all the others, he knew that holding back wouldn't be any favor to Kate, would in fact offend his sister, and so the Cavalier of Two Worlds gave it everything he had. On this day, everything he had wasn't enough to overcome his sister. Stripped first of his weapon and then of his rose, he retired with a smile. In the center of the room, surrounded by wrecked roses, Caitlin was breathing hard, her face flushed and bathed in sweat, her hair escaping from the ponytail she'd put it in to stick to her cheeks and fall down her sweat-darkened back.
"Is that it?" Utrina wondered. "We're all out of duelists, and..."
"Next!" Caitlin barked. The next combatant was humanoid and female, but aside from that it was hard to tell anything much about her. She was wearing regulation fencing garb, including the mask, and wielded a competition saber. Utrina found this very puzzling. Who could she be? Someone from New Avalon she hadn't met? Kate's mother, maybe? She couldn't recall having heard that Kay Morgan was a fencer. No, there was Kay in the other line, next to Captain Picard. Who the... As Kate and her new opponent clashed, a suspicion started forming in Utina's mind. She knew she'd seen that body line, that particular fencer's style, before. She might not have the memory for form and nuance that, say, Jury had, but she knew when she was looking at someone she herself had dueled. But that was ridiculous. What would she be doing here? Unless something had really changed over the last 5 days, it seemed tremendously unlikely. The fencer lost her rose. There was a pause as Caitlin dropped back to her customary ready stance and her beaten opponent straightened. Then the fencer raised her saber in acknowledgement, backed up, and removed her mask. Well, by God, it was Liza Broadbank. Utrina blinked in flat-out astonishment at the sight of the curly blonde hair tumbling free from the mask. The flush in the fencer's cheeks, and the smile, not much of one, but there was one, nonetheless, on her face. Oh, she'd seen Liza smile before, but never genuinely. Beside Utrina, Azalin shifted restively, leaning over to mutter, "Look at that, the nerve!" "I'm sure she wouldn't be here if Kate didn't want her," Utrina replied. "But I'm just as mystified." "I'm not mystified," Azalin replied. "I'm just disgusted." Utrina blinked. Such bitterness was exceedingly rare from Azalin, who was normally the most equable of creatures, and said nothing as Kate called for her next challenger. Next came Captain Krontep, who disadvantaged himself as to reach by choosing to fight armed only with a Duktag, the short Klingon ceremonial dueling knife. He was very fast, using his light for a Klingon build to good effect, and he moved with no fear of Kate's blade in him. He was the first combatant to suffer an actual injury, a cut to his cheek as he flashed inside Kate's arc to snag her rose with one of his Duktag's two outswept wing blades. Kate bowed to him, took his rose to replace her own, barked, "Again!" once more, and squared herself for her next opponent. As he stepped forward, Utrina resolved not to bother being surprised at anything further which might happen today, because at the rate she was going, she was liable to wind up with her eyebrows cranked all the way to the top of her skull by the time this was over. One of the men in a Starfleet uniform, whom Utrina had thought surely must be here simply to observe, had just stepped out onto the floor. Captain Jean-Luc Picard. Picard was a fairly small man, not impressively tall, and rather wiry of build, and he was in apparent age the oldest man in the room, probably somewhere around 50. He had a lean, patrician face and was almost completely bald, with just a short-cropped fringe of silver hair around the back of his head. In his right hand he carried a dueling saber, and as he faced off against Caitlin, he struck a fencer's pose like Jury or Mickey would use. "Wow," whispered Azalin, who'd apparently recovered from her snit. "Look at him! Isn't he just to die for?" Utrina gave the Dantrovian a peculiar look and did not reply. Azalin shrugged as if to say, "Your loss, friend," and went back to her previous pose of rapt attention. Picard was good, though. He wasn't as fast as Miki, or quite as razor-precise as Jury, but he had experience and cunning, and he knew how to use them. Twice he penetrated Caitlin's guard, only to fall short of her rose because of a desperate twist of her body or an almost impossible freehand counter. More often than not, he held the positional advantage.
In a fencing match, he would almost certainly have won. But, as Liza Broadbank had learned not once but twice to her chagrin, a rose duel is not a fencing match. Eventually, the captain slipped up, lost his bloom, and, grinning broadly, saluted his opponent before retiring. The next challenger was the Enterprise's Klingon security officer, Lieutenant Worf. Like Professor Krog, the Institute Duelist Society's erstwhile faculty advisor, he fought with a batleth, that most revered and traditional of Klingon weapons, and like Krog, he was very good with it, but on this day, not quite good enough. In defeat, he was gracious. He drew himself up, saluted her with his batleth, and boomed in an almost tectonic voice, "Kai kasai, souvui!" Next was the ponytailed Vulcan woman from the Challenger's staff, T'Vec. Griffin had introduced her to Utena some days previously as his chief of security and a novice student of Katsujin Kenryu. And indeed, she faced Caitlin armed not with a live blade, but with a boken. Though clearly a beginner in terms of technique, the Vulcan had an excellent kinesthetic sense and remarkable command of her body. Caitlin defeated her without much difficulty, but it wasn't a walkover either. By now, Kate was a shambles, her hair in total disarray, her bangs plastered to her forehead by sweat, her monske soaked. She was starting to slow down, to make small but telling mistakes. That fire was still in her eyes, though, her spirit undimmed by the growing fatigue of her body, and it carried her through the next challenge, which was from another Klingon, Subcommander Klang, a cousin of Professor Krog's, and the Challenger's science officer. The warrior of science fought not with a batleth, but with a more normal-looking sword whose Klingon name Utena didn't know. Though he was not as skilled as the Enterprise officer, he was big even for a Klingon, and he had a lot of tenacity. Kate barely scraped past him. And as he saluted her and retired, it looked as if the duelist leader had just about had it. Her monske was coming undone, revealing the perspiration-soaked black t-shirt underneath. Her glasses looked like they were fogging up. Several times during the fight with Klang, she'd had to adjust her grip on her Zatoichi as her sweat-slick hands slipped on the smooth wood. Now she stood in the center of the room, wobbling slightly in her stance. Suddenly, with quick, almost violent movements, Kate took the rose from her monske pocket, removed her glasses, stuck them in the pocket instead, stripped the garment off, tossed it to Utena, and then put the rose in her t-shirt pocket instead. Then she raked her free hand through her bangs, shoving her wet hair back away from her face, shook her head, and said in that same percussive tone, "Next!" Utena wondered how long this was supposed to go on. Until Kate passed out? At the level of fatigue she was pushing herself to, she might make a mistake that got somebody hurt. Herself or her opponent, these were still live weapon duels. What Kate was going through here, Utena imagined it was like she had fought her entire Rose Tournament in a single session, instead of spread out over the course of a school year. As the next challenger took his place, Utena realized with a shock, however firmly she'd promised herself that she wouldn't be shocked by anything else that happened today, that it was Kate's younger brother Leonard. What was he doing here? Dumb question, someone must have brought him for this, but still. Like T'Vec, Len was a less experienced student, though he was several years ahead of the Vulcan. Still, in her present condition, Kate was almost no match for him. They ended up in a draw, and again the room seemed to sag. After all that, it did seem kind of an anticlimax, as Kate turned to her father, the question plain on her face. Then, to the room's surprise, but resolutely not Utena's, he took another rose from inside his gi and threw it to her. She caught it, and without complaint or demur, placed it in her pocket and called for her next challenger. Utena was starting to feel a little bit of outrage toward Kate's father. She knew he was sensei and all, but wasn't this getting just a little excessive? Kate was exhausted, almost passing out on her feet, and what was more, she looked like she'd hurt herself in her clash with Leonard. As she moved now, she favored her right leg slightly, as if she'd strained her hamstring, perhaps,
or maybe wrenched her knee. And still the men expected her to fight on? What was the point? Surely she demonstrated her skill and her courage by now. This was starting to approach the point where it resembled blood sport, and Utina felt herself getting angry. What she saw next didn't make her feel any better. From the end of the duelist's line, the bulky figure of Professor Krall rose from his meditation posture and took the floor, unslinging his own batleth from his back. Krall Gvestai Kalan was a master with many Klingon weapons, but none so much as the batleth. Part of the reason he was the black sheep of the House of Kalan, despite being, at the same time, an honored senior member, was the fact that, though such a capable and famed warrior, he chose to spend his days not in glorious battle against the enemies of the Empire, but rather by teaching the Klingon language to human children. Some of his fellow Klingons believed that his educator's life on Earth, a soft, decadent planet, had cost him his edge. Having fought a rose duel with him herself, Utina Tenjo didn't believe that for an instant. The professor, clad in the full battle armor he had almost never worn on campus, was not quite as large as his cousin Klang, but he was faster for it. Utina winced as he pummeled Kate mercilessly, driving her around the room with almost contemptuous ease. She couldn't match him for strength, speed, or ferocity, not in the condition she was in now, anyway. All she could do was defend and retreat, defend and retreat. The end of this was inevitable, and Utina felt her heart sink. This trial, which had started out so exhilarating, was starting to resemble one of those horrid, hopeless ancient video games that had no victory condition, just an ever-escalating level of difficulty until the player's inevitable eradication. And then, Krog, roaring his best challenge, lunged forward, his blade hissing through the air. For one horrifying moment, it looked to Utina as if he'd reached too far, as if Caitlin wouldn't be able to get out of the way, as if the prong of his batleth would surely strike more than the flower, spearing through Kate's thin shirt and her fragile skin to her heart. Kate, weak with exhaustion, flowed away from the blow like water. For an instant, the fire crackled through the fatigue dulling her eyes, and the tip of her own blade whispered. Professor Krog was defeated, and as he bellowed his approval and retired, Caitlin could barely stand. She stood, her knees sagging, arms limp, chest heaving, sweat dripping audibly from her chin to the floor, and regarded her father with blurred eyes. Griffin rose smoothly to his feet and bowed to her. And for an instant Utina felt relief. It was finally over. Had Kate at last done enough? Then Griffin stepped aside, the door behind him opened, and the room gave an almost silent gasp of shock. He was tall, impossibly tall and imposing, dressed head to toe in purple, cloaked, the lower half of his face obscured by a scarf, the upper by the shadow from a broad-brimmed slouch hat. He entered the room with a smooth, precise tread that somehow combined the terrifying implacability of a machine with the leisurely calm of an unconcerned man. The left side of his cloak was flung back over his shoulder, revealing a violet rose almost blending into the rest of his costume where it rode in the pocket of his double-breasted jacket. Without a word, Hammer straightened his right arm out from his side, flicking back that side of his cloak as well, and a gleaming triangular sword sang out of the sleeve of his coat. Utina came halfway to her feet, mouth opening to protest. No, damn it, this was just too much. Look at her! When she saw something that froze her in place. One of Hammer's eyes, faintly glowing slashes of white in the shadow of his hat, flickered at her. He'd winked. Her protest dying in her throat, still almost sick with worry, Utina turned to look at Caitlin and abandoned her resolution about surprise yet again. Slowly, as she gazed across at the awesome apparition that was her childhood hero, Caitlin rose from her exhausted slump. Her knees unbent, her back straightened. Her shoulders came up and back. Her chin rose defiantly. The fire behind her eyes burned away the fog of fatigue and glittered more brightly than ever. She raised her blade and snapped in a voice like an electric arc.
Next!
In her days as a duelist, Utrinna Tenjo had seen a woman kiss the tip of a blade and make it burn with a fire that could slice through steel. She'd seen and performed almost impossible feats of athleticism and courage. She'd witnessed a million flying swords cutting a stone tower to ribbons, cut a speeding automobile in half, been transfixed through the heart and yet somehow kept living, kept fighting. She had never seen anything like what happened next. Though, truth be told, she didn't really see about half of it. A quarter of the time, Martin Rose was moving too fast to be seen. Another quarter, Caitlin was simply invisible. At one time, Utrinna had seen Rose jump almost 100 feet straight into the air and not come down. The size of the room constrained him slightly, but he was still like a purple tornado as he swept through the room, silent and intent. He used only the one blade, and who knows what portion of his strength he held back, but it was a true duel for all that. Kate hadn't used the mysterious power of invisibility she seemed to have against any of her other opponents. But against Hammer she employed it judiciously, vanishing for seconds at a time here and there, which almost gave her the appearance of being able to teleport for short distances. He was her greatest challenge, and, pushed beyond exhaustion, she rose to meet him. Now, suddenly, with the clarity of a sunrise, Utrinna understood. Understood the purpose of the entire trial. Understood Griffin's apparent cruelty. Understood the inevitability of the ending. From opposite sides of the room, Hammer and Caitlin sprang at each other, Hammer silent, Caitlin letting out a warrior's roar that would have done Krog proud. They met in the center of the room with a blinding flash of light from the meeting point of their blades, passed by each other, and stopped almost all the way to the opposite walls. For an instant, there was utter and complete silence, and then the very, very softest of sounds. Hammer's violet rose dropped to the floor. Caitlin wavered for a moment in her follow-through stance, looking as if she would surely drop her sword and fall at least to her knees, if not prone. Then she gathered herself, straightened, squared herself, and bowed to her father, whom she had ended up standing perhaps 5 feet away from. Griffin rose from the César he'd resumed after admitting Hammer, bowed solemnly in return, and spoke a single soft word that resounded to the corners of the dojo despite its softness. Enough. Then he took a pace forward and enfolded his daughter in his arms. The dojo erupted in cheers and applause. Hammer retracted his sword, took off his hat, pulled down his scarf, and winked at Utrinna again as both of them went to join the mob hug. Juriari Sugawa finished showering, stepped out of the cubicle, dried herself, put on her dressing gown, and then left the shower cube's little enclosure at the end of the ambassadorial suite's palatial bathroom to find Caitlin exactly where she'd been when Juri went into the shower, soaking in the thermotub, immersed but for her head from the nose up. "You'd best get ready," said Juri in a tone of faint amusement. "We don't want to be late for Captain Krontep's dinner." Kate raised herself slowly another inch or two, so she could speak, and said, I can't move. "After the show you put on this afternoon, I don't doubt it," said Juri. "Would you like me to convey your apologies to the captain?" Kate looked seriously tempted, then sighed. No, she said resignedly. I want to go. I don't get to see Krontep very often. She raised a hand out of the water, winced, and lowered it again. I might not be able to get out of the tub, though, she observed ruefully. Juri smiled again. "Well, I'm not coming in after you," she said. "I'd get all wet." What a shame, said Kate, downcast. "It is," Juri agreed.
As captain of the Otori Academy fencing team, I had to learn a thing or two about sports medicine. I could probably help you a bit with the soreness and stiffness you must be developing by now. She sighed regretfully. If only you weren't trapped in that tub.
Kate made an incoherent grumbling noise, gathered her will, and levered herself partway up, then raised the hand again.
You'll have to help me, she said.
As Utna, who had stayed behind on Challenger to talk for a few moments with Krog and Klang, entered the suite, she heard the mighty splash from the bathroom, performed a quick bit of deductive reasoning, and decided there was no percentage in getting involved in that. Instead of checking in with her temporary suite mates, she just went to the master bedroom, grabbed her IPO Space Force dress uniform, yelled, "Half-hour warning!" and then beat it for the hangar bay. She could use the shower on Dagger Disc instead. As Krontep led the duelist through the corridors of his ship, the Klingon captain was practically rubbing his hands together with delight. "You are going to have a marvelous time," he promised them. "It just so happens that Saturday nights have become a traditional night in the Imperial Navy, a night when the crews of all ships gather together in their mess halls and enjoy a traditional food which is wildly popular throughout the Klingon Empire." Amanda, who knew a thing or two about Klingon food, felt her face falling. "Oh, no," she said. "No, you can't mean..."
"Exactly," said Krontep, his eyes gleaming.
He thumped the activator next to the great double doors leading into the main mess hall, and as they slid open, he whirled with a flourish and bellowed,
"Ladies and gentlemen, it's taco night!"
The room was immense, full of ranked bench tables and the smell of seasoned meat. It looked like the ship's whole crew was gathered in there, crowded along the benches, banging steel mugs against the tables and cheering for their honored guest. In the corner, a 5-man mariachi band on a raised dais struck up a peppy southwestern tune. The sight of 5 Klingons with bandoliers and sombreros over their uniforms almost shattered Amanda Dessler's mind. Utena Tenjo, on the other hand, almost laughed herself sick. One of the mariachis, the one playing the trumpet, was Helmsman Koth, whose quirky sense of humor she had gotten to know quite well during her Captain for a Day experience. The young Klingon officer had been thrilled to learn that the ship's visitor was a Maiduj Bortas fan. Some poor asteroid off in the Epsilon Eridani system's Oort cloud had felt the wrath of the Vengeance during their patrol sweep and had learned the folly of opposing the will of the Emperor. Strung across the wall at the back of the room were 2 enormous banners. One read, in standard and Klingon Picard, "Congratulations, Caitlin." The other, slung underneath, declared in large red letters, "A winner is you." Martin Rose was standing on a chair to finish securing one end of that one, which should give some idea how high the mess hall ceiling is. Amanda, the most experienced of the group with starships, estimated that it extended upward for at least 2 decks, possibly 3. She noted the retractable walls, the grooves for which divided the long bench tables here and there, enabling the huge room to be converted into a cluster of meeting chambers. Partial command crews from all the key starships were present, as well as Commanders Johnson and Ivanova from Babylon 5. Jer was an old friend of Krontep and much of his command staff. As a lieutenant commander, he had been Derek Bacon's first officer aboard the good old Servo, the only other human aboard. He and Krontep swapped war stories, enlivening the head table with tales of the wondrous adventures of that greatest of WDF sector patrol teams, the battleship Pennsylvania, NCC 2317, and her faithful escort, the Servo. While that was going on, Martin, Rose, and Caitlin took the time they hadn't had in their earlier encounter to have a proper lost-time embrace. When he finally put her down, Rose grinned and said, "Well, well, little Kate's a master now. What do you know about that?" Kate slumped with exaggerated, but not much, exhaustion into the bench next to Jury as Martin sat down opposite her.
"I still can't believe I did all that," said Kate. "It's unreal. 18 opponents, 4 Klingons, and you.
I never dreamed I could still be standing after something like that. Never in my life thought I could summon up that kind of endurance.
Martin smiled. I gathered that was kind of the idea, he observed.
Apparently so, said Kate. I doubt I'd ever be able to do it again, though. And you must have been holding back quite a bit.
I'll never tell, replied Rose with a twinkling smile. At about that moment, Jury reached over and nonchalantly resumed a facet of the massage she'd given Caitlin earlier, the one which had enabled the newly minted Kenjutsu master to emerge from their suite in Green Sector and come to this party in the first place. Kate's eyes about half closed, a low, contented sound coming from her throat, as the red-headed duelist's strong fingers gently but firmly kneaded the nape of her neck.
"Oh," she said, sounding a bit sleepy. "I'm sorry. You two haven't met, have you?"
"No, I don't believe we have," said Martin, squashing an inappropriate internal desire to add, "Hello, nurse."
Martin Rose, this is Juri Arisugawa. My childhood hero, Martin Rose.
I am the terror that flaps in the night, and I am pleased to make your acquaintance, said Martin in an overly grave parody of his Batman voice, which didn't go at all with his relaxed civilian clothes.
Charmed, said Juri. Kate didn't volunteer an elaboration on her exact relation with Jury, and neither did Jury. That suited Martin fine, it wasn't really any of his business anyway. But if it was something like what it resembled, well, then, bully for Caitlin. He grinned and offered Jury the nearest bowl of salsa. Aya Nakajima and her party arrived a little late and somewhat pre-lubricated, which livened things up a considerable amount. As the tacos, which were extremely good, were consumed and the band played on, now pressed into service as a karaoke backup band, a good time was had by all. Well, almost all. Zarg Tholic sat off by himself, or at least as off by oneself as one can get in a communal dining room, his face set in a mask of resigned duty as he picked at his quesadilla and wished time would accelerate. Aside from him, though, only one guest was visibly failing to have a good time. Much to Miki Koru's shock, that one guest was Azalin Devere Natashkin, who stood in a corner of the room, her arms folded, almost rigid with disapproval at the presence of Liza Broadbank. To be sure, there were some others who wouldn't have logged Liza's presence as their first choice, but for the most part the blonde was being tolerated. Her genuine repentance had gone a long way toward softening the attitudes of the various duelists and company toward her. Amanda had even made the gesture of issuing her an imperial pardon for her actions, stating that the true conspirator had been dealt with, and announcing a general amnesty for any surviving accomplices. With that done, and in light of Caitlin's having accepted her old enemy as one of her trial opponents, the others were treating her more like a recovering victim than one of the architects of their recent troubles. Corwin was over there right now having a perfectly civil conversation with her. Stick? The blonde asked, leaning over as a Klingon steward brought more chimichangas to their end of the table.
I thought you were over that snide phase, Corwin replied with an easy grin.
Sorry, said Liza, but still, you named your magic staff Stick?
You'll never forget the name, Corwin replied, still grinning.
And that just made Azalin feel sick.
Miki made his way over to her and asked, as diplomatically as he could, what was wrong.
Look at the way they're treating her, Azalin replied.
Who, Liza?
No, Commander Finney. Yes, Liza. Look at Devlin, for Chazar's sake. He's smiling at her. She turned him into the Psychor, and he's sitting there smiling at her.
Devlin's had a bit to drink, said Miki. At any rate, he can afford to be forgiving. He's safe now.
Miki turned troubled eyes to Azalin.
I've never seen you act this way before, Azalin. It's disturbing.
Esalyn's annoyed golden eyes flicked away from Liza and met his.
"Act what way?" she asked sharply.
"Angry. Vengeful. You're the most forgiving person I know. You helped heal Sionji, who was every bit as bad to his peers in his time as Liza has been. Gave him the second chance he needed to become the man he is today. What's different about Liza? Is it that you've seen her dark side firsthand while you've only heard the stories about Sionji's?"
"No, it's not that," said Azalin unconvincingly.
"What, then?" Miki persisted. "It can't be something as basic as gender, can it? You forgave Sionji because he's a man, but..."
"No," Azalin snapped. "Look, drop it, all right? I'm not in the mood."
"No," Miki replied, quietly but flatly. "I won't drop it. Something's wrong, Azalin. This isn't like you."
"How the hell do you know what's like me?" she asked angrily.
Miki didn't rile in response. He merely replied to the rhetorical question.
"You've been showing me since the second day of the summoning of the spring wind. Holding a grudge isn't your way. I would go so far as to guess that it's a form of hurting yourself, and snubbing someone for her past mistakes is definitely an act of malice. None of that is like you, according to all that you've tried to teach me."
Esalyn glared at him and opened her mouth to refute him. Then she seemed to hear some inner voice, and blinked in shock and dismay.
"Deville,"
she whispered, appalled.